Good afternoon, IPPA. My name is Ted Bohm. I'm an attorney with Fisher & Phillips. We are a national labor and employment law firm with offices in more than 30 cities across the country, and I am a partner in the Atlanta office of Fisher & Phillips. Happy to be speaking with you today on the Family First COVID-19 Response Act, and I want to thank Cheryl Whelan for setting this up. I hope this is a informative and helpful presentation for you. To the extent you have additional questions, follow-up questions, or want to discuss any other employment law matters, we are, of course, happy to assist you with those. As an IPPA member, you are entitled to a 10% discount on our standard hourly rates. I also want to direct you to our website because there is a wealth of free information on our website, including a FAQ for employers document that we are updating daily with lots of good COVID-19 information for employers. And we are putting out legal alerts every day and sometimes many times a day on federal issues and state-specific issues as well. Today will be a discussion about the two new paid sick leave laws that will be going into effect on April 1st. Originally, we thought it would be April 2nd, but the Department of Labor this week stated that it is going to take the position that these are effective April 1st. So that's the date that everyone should go with. This has been fast-moving legislation for Congress. The House first passed this legislation on March 14th. They made some technical corrections 2 days later. The Senate passed the bill on the 18th of March, and President Trump signed it into law that same day. The law said it would be effective 15 days later, but the Department of Labor has decided that it will be effective April 1. So we will be discussing the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act and the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Act today. I do want to note that this bill also includes funding for unemployment insurance across the states. And then there are also tax credits, which will reimburse employers for any paid sick payments under these laws, and we will discuss that further during the presentation. So we're going to start with the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. And this law will cover any employer who has fewer than 500 employees. Large employers, i.e. those with more than 500 employees, are exempt from this law. So a question that is arising for many employers is, do I qualify as a large employer based on a scenario which is somewhat common where there is one corporation that has some subsidiaries, for example, each of which is incorporated itself, and none of those various corporate entities has 500 or more employees by themselves, but if you aggregate all of those entities, you would exceed the 500 employee threshold. And so many clients are asking if they can do that to qualify as a large employer and be exempt. And the answer is maybe. There is a multi-factor test that the Department of Labor will look at to determine if those entities should be aggregated to constitute a single integrated employer. For example, they will look to see if there's common ownership, if there is interrelation of operations between the corporate entities, if there is a centralized labor relations or human resources office or function for the separate entities. Very often in these scenarios, there are certain facts that will support single integrated status, which would allow you to qualify as a large employer. And then there will be facts that undercut that status. And often at the end of the day, it comes down to a question of risk tolerance for your organization and whether you are willing to take a certain amount of risk by claiming large employer exempt status under these facts. I encourage you to discuss that scenario internally with your counsel before making that conclusion as opposed to just jumping to it, because it is a very fact-specific analysis. And it's not an easy one. Assuming that your organization is covered and that you are not a large employer or for our audience, if your clients are not a large employer and they are covered by this law, any of their employees will be eligible for paid leave under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. There is no minimum days or hours of employment requirement. If the employee is sick, the employee is entitled to paid sick leave of up to 80 hours. The 80-hour amount applies to full-time employees. Part-time employees are entitled to hours based on their average number of hours that the employee worked for the 6 month period preceding the taking of leave, or if they were employed for less than 6 months, the average number of hours per week they normally would have been scheduled. So full-time employees are entitled up to at least 80 hours, or to a maximum of 80 hours, I should say, and part-time employees are going to be entitled to a number of hours based on their work over the preceding 6 month period. There are six qualifying reasons for leave under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. Employers must provide sick time to the extent the employee is unable to work or telework due to a need for leave, because the first qualifying reason is that the employee is subject to a federal, state, or local quarantine or isolation order related to COVID-19. And let me stop right here, because one question that we have received from a lot of clients, particularly in states or in localities where there is a shelter-in-place order, is whether such a shelter-in-place order qualifies as a qualifying reason for leave. Basically, does a shelter-in-place order equal a federal, state, or local quarantine or isolation order? And that answer is unknown at this point. We need the Department of Labor to clarify that issue, and we expect that they will. They just have not done that yet. At this point, there are two schools of thought here. One is that because a shelter-in-place order is not specifically mentioned in the legislation, that it does not constitute a qualifying reason for leave. So that if you are in a state where there is a shelter-in-place order, if that order goes out, you would not be able to utilize that shelter-in-place, your employee would not be able to utilize that shelter-in-place order as a reason for qualifying leave. And also, if your client's business is deemed an essential business and is exempt from one of those shelter-in-place orders, those employees would not be able to claim paid sick leave under the EPSLA or the EFMLA, for that matter, for that additional reason, because even if a shelter-in-place order is considered a qualifying reason for leave, if the business is an essential business and is exempt from the shelter-in-place order, that removes any basis at all from the employee claiming leave for that reason. The other school of thought is that a shelter-in-place order is very much similar to a federal, state, or local quarantine or isolation order, and that it should constitute a qualifying reason for leave. Obviously, the financial implications to this question are significant. If a shelter-in-place order is deemed a qualifying reason for leave under this law, that covers a lot of employees out there. And so that is certainly something that we need the Department of Labor to clarify, and we expect that they will. The second qualifying reason for paid sick leave under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act is if the employee has been advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine due to COVID-19 concerns. The third reason is if the employee is experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 and is seeking testing or a medical diagnosis. The fourth qualifying reason is if the employee is caring for an individual who is subject to an order or self-quarantine as described above. The fifth reason is if the employee is caring for a son or daughter if school or childcare is closed. And the sixth reason is sort of a catch-all, i.e. if the employee is experiencing any other substantially similar conditions specified by HHS. So these are the six qualifying reasons for Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, and any other reason would not be a qualifying reason. For instance, if you're in a state where there's no shelter-in-place order and an employee says that they are fearful of coming into work because they don't want to, you know, potentially be exposed to something, and we're not aware of any of our employees who have symptoms or who has tested positive, that employee's concern or fear about coming into work would not be a qualifying reason for leave under the EPSLA, and you could deny their request for paid leave. So how much is the pay for an employee who takes leave under this law? And the answer to that depends on which of the reasons they identify for the leave. If their reason for the leave relates to themselves, let's go back to reasons 1, 2, or 3, i.e. the employee is subject to a local quarantine or isolation order, they've been advised by a doctor to self-quarantine, or they're experiencing symptoms and are seeking testing, then those employees are to be paid at the higher of their regular rate, the federal minimum wage, or any local minimum wage. So those employees are entitled, if they're full-time, for example, they're entitled to their full regular rate of pay for 80 hours of leave. On the other hand, if the employee's reason for leave relates to somebody else, and let's go back and look at reasons 4, 5, and 6. If the reason for leave is to take care of an individual, not necessarily a family member, but an individual who is subject to an order or self-quarantine, or if they're taking care of their son or daughter because of a school cancellation or daycare cancellation, then they are only entitled to 2/3 of their regular rate of leave under the EPSLA. So the reason for leave is significant under this particular law. Generally speaking, if the reason for leave relates to the employee's own health conditions, they're entitled to their full regular rate of pay for their number of hours of paid sick leave. If their reason for leave relates to somebody else, including a family member, they're only entitled to 2/3 their regular rate of pay for that leave period. There are also caps on the amount of sick leave pay. So there is a $511 daily cap for anyone who takes sick leave for their own condition, reasons 1, 2, or 3. And then there is a $5,110 aggregate cap for those employees who take leave for their own health conditions, reasons 1, 2, or 3. There are lower caps for employees who take leave to take care of somebody else. There is a $200 per day daily cap for those employees who need leave to take care of somebody else or their family member or their son or daughter because of school being canceled. And then the aggregate cap for those employees would be $2,000 for the full leave period. So, big picture, what you need to remember is different rates of pay for the employees based on the reasons for leave, different sets of caps, both daily and aggregate caps, based on the reasons for leave. The law does have an exemption for an employer of an employee who is a healthcare provider or an emergency responder. Those employees can be excluded from application of this law. The Department of Labor also has authority to issue regulations to exclude certain healthcare providers and emergency responders from the definition of eligible employee. The Department of Labor also has authority to potentially exempt employers with fewer than 50 employees. So that will be something to watch in the coming days ahead. We do expect the Department of Labor to issue clarifying regulations for the EPSLA, and it's possible that they will decide to exempt employers who have fewer than 50 employees. They have not done that yet. That's something to watch, and we certainly will be watching that as a firm, and we'll be publishing a legal alert as soon as we get those clarifying regulations. Some other general rules about the EPSLA. Sick leave does not carry over. So this law is designed to sunset on December 31st, 2020. If an employee has not used all of the hours that they are potentially entitled to under this law, they don't get to carry those hours over into 2021. Employers may not require employees as a condition of taking paid leave to first find a replacement to cover their shift or their scheduled hours. So in other words, your clients can't say to their employees, yes, I'll give you paid sick leave under this law, but only if you find a coworker to cover, you know, your shift while you're out. That's prohibited. Employees may first use this paid sick time under this law before any other paid leave that their employer might provide as a company benefit. That's up to the employee. And employers can't require employees to use other paid leave that's provided by the employer before using this paid sick leave. So in other words, if one of your clients has a company policy that provides for paid sick leave, those companies can't require their employees to first use any accrued company paid sick leave hours before taking leave under this law. That paid sick leave that they have through their company is waiting for them on the back end of their use of the paid leave under this law. There will be a notice required under the EPSLA, and actually the Department of Labor published a model notice yesterday. So you can go either to our website, because we link to it, or directly to the Department of Labor website, and there will be a model notice that you should advise your customers, your clients, to have posted up alongside other required employment law posters, such as the minimum wage, FMLA, et cetera. Employers are able to require employees to follow reasonable notice procedures in order to continue receiving such paid sick time. Basically, what that means is if you have an employee who says, I have symptoms and I'm going to go get testing, it's reasonable for the employer to say, fine, you can go out on paid sick leave, but contact us in 4 or 5 days, whatever it may be, to let us know your status, whether you've gotten testing, you know, the test results, things of that nature. It's reasonable to have such notice procedures in place, but I would just advise employers out there generally, don't be overly restrictive or heavy-handed when it comes to notice procedures. Again, this law goes into effect, according to the Department of Labor, on April 1, and it sunsets on December 31st, 2020. So, the way that employers get reimbursed for this paid sick leave payment is through tax credit. Employers subject to the requirements of this law are entitled to a refundable tax credit equal to the amount of qualified paid sick leave requirements that they pay out per quarter. And the tax credits are capped as follows: $511 per day per person for qualifying reasons 1, 2, and 3. Again, if the leave is for the employee's own health condition, generally speaking, then the tax credit cap will be $511 per day. If the leave is for someone else's situation, health condition, or because a school is closed, then the tax credits will be capped at $200 per day. And the tax credits are applied against the employer's Social Security taxes, but employers are reimbursed if their cost for qualified leave exceeds the taxes that they would owe. This week, we got some unofficial guidance from the IRS, or sort of an advance warning that they will be issuing guidance to address the cash flow challenge that is created by this tax credit. And that's something I've heard from a lot of clients, which is, you know, look, these tax credits are great, but we have a significant drop in revenue right now. We have a serious cash flow shortage problem, and we just don't know that we're going to be able to pay out this paid sick leave, and the reimbursement through tax credits just won't happen fast enough. And so the IRS, I think, understands this, and they're trying to come up with ways to address this problem. And the guidance will allow employers to retain an amount of payroll taxes equal to the amount of paid leave that they paid, rather than depositing that amount with the IRS in anticipation of the tax credit. And so there was an example provided here. If an eligible employer paid $5,000 in sick leave and is otherwise required to deposit $8,000 in payroll taxes, including taxes withheld from all employees, the employer could use up to $5,000 of the $8,000 of taxes it was going to deposit for making qualified leave payments. The employer would only be required under the law to deposit the remaining $3,000 on its next regular deposit date. So, and again, I think the IRS is trying to come up with ways that will allow employers to make these paid sick leave payments, but not, you know, completely get buckled under financially while they wait for the tax credit. And we should get more guidance on that in the coming days. The next law we will be discussing here is the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Act. So, like the EPSLA, the EFMLA applies to employers who have fewer than 500 employees. So the same issue and scenario that we discussed previously with EPSLA applies here. You know, do we have more than 500 employees if we aggregate all of our various subsidiaries? The same analysis applies here that applied earlier. So think through that carefully as you're making that decision as to whether you know, your client should claim large employer exempt status. And we'll probably get more guidance from the Department of Labor on this issue soon, hopefully. This is a big expansion of the traditional FMLA. Typically, as most of you know, for an employee to have to be eligible for traditional unpaid FMLA leave, they will have had to have worked for you for a certain period of time. They will have, you know, been required to work over the 12-month period, 1,250 hours. None of that applies here. As long as the employee worked for an employer for 30 days prior to taking leave and has a qualifying reason for leave, they are eligible to take paid leave. And it's up to 12 weeks of job protected paid leave, although the first 10 days are unpaid under the EFMLA. So weeks 2 through 12 would be paid under the EFMLA. The first 10 days are unpaid under the EFMLA. However, as I said at the beginning, these laws work hand in hand. So an employee can get paid under the EPSLA during that first 10-day period. Then once that has been exhausted, they could transition over to the EFMLA and be paid under that law, provided that they have a qualifying reason under the EFMLA. And whereas the EPSLA had 6 qualifying reasons, there's only 1 qualifying reason for leave under the EFMLA. If an employee is unable to work or telework due to the need for leave to take care of the son or daughter under 18 years of age, if the school or place of care has been closed, or the child care provider of the son or daughter is unavailable due to a public health emergency. And an emergency with respect to COVID-19 certainly qualifies as a public health emergency. So really, there is only 1 qualifying reason for leave under the EFMLA, and that is if the employee has to stay home because a child's school or daycare has been canceled, or the child care provider is unavailable. That's it. That's the only qualifying reason for leave under the EFMLA. And let me add that son or daughter does not exclusively mean biological son or daughter. It can be foster children, adopted children, things like that. It's not strictly biological. As I said, the first 10 days of EFMLA are unpaid. However, if the employee seeks paid leave under the EPSLA, they could be paid that way for the first 10 days before the pay portion of EFMLA kicks in weeks 2 through 12. Also, if the employee has accrued company PTO, vacation, or sick leave, they could use that accrued hours during the first 10 days if they chose to, although the employer can't require them to use that leave, that paid leave during that time. After the first 10 days, for the remainder of the EFMLA period, the last 10 weeks, in other words, employees are compensated at 2/3 of their regular rate of pay. And part-time employees will be compensated based on the part-time, and irregular schedule employees will be entitled to pay based on an average number of hours that the employee worked in the preceding 6-month period, or if they were employed for less than 6 months, the average number of hours the employee would normally be scheduled to work. So it sort of depends on what the employee's scheduled hours were, if they were, you know, sort of always scheduled the same number of hours week to week, you would calculate their paid sick leave based on those set hours at 2/3 their regular rate. If they work an irregular schedule or if they're part-time employees, then you would look at the average number of hours that the employee worked in the preceding 6-month period. And just as there are caps under the EPFLA, there are also caps under the EFMLA. So pay is capped at $200 per day and $10,000 in the aggregate per employee. Similarly to the EPFLA, there is also an exemption under the EFMLA for employees of employers who are healthcare providers or emergency responders. They can be excluded from the application of this law. And again, the Department of Labor has the authority to potentially exempt if it chooses to, employers who have fewer than 50 employees, and can exempt certain healthcare providers and emergency responders from the definition of an eligible employee. Job restoration or reinstatement. So under the traditional FMLA, for any of you out there who are familiar with this, if an employee goes out on traditional FMLA leave, they are entitled to be restored to their same job or an equivalent position when they return. They have to get the same pay, same benefits, et cetera, like things of that nature. So that same obligation applies under the EFMLA if the employer has 25 or more employees. However, if the employer has fewer than 25 employees, that job restoration reinstatement obligation of the FMLA may not apply for an employee who takes leave and then their job position is eliminated due to economic conditions during their leave period. The employer, you know, will have certain obligations to reach out to the employee during that time period. They will have to restore the employee to an equivalent position if it can. And if the efforts to restore the employee to the equivalent position fail, that they continue to reach out to the employee if an equivalent position becomes available during the one-year period beginning on the earlier of either the date on which the qualifying need related to a public health emergency concludes, or the date that is 12 weeks after the date on which the employee's leave for EFMLA commences. Simply put, if a company has fewer than 25 employees and an employee goes out on EFMLA leave, there could be a scenario where that employee is not entitled to be restored to their same job position if the position that they worked in has been eliminated and there are no equivalent positions. So how does this interplay with other paid leave laws? As I said, full-time employees can take their 80 hours of emergency paid sick leave, if applicable and if they have a qualifying reason, for the first 10 days of the EFMLA leave period, which would otherwise be unpaid under the EFMLA. But these laws are designed to work hand in hand. employees may also elect to use other accrued paid leaves, such as vacation hours and PTO hours, during the first 10 days if they decide to. At this point, it's not explicitly clear if eligibility for EFMLA and FMLA is 12 weeks total, or if this new EFMLA creates a whole new 12-week period of paid protected leave. We believe that is an incorrect interpretation of the statute, and that this new EFMLA does not create a whole new 12-week leave period. Rather, if you take 12 weeks of EFMLA, for example, you don't get another 12 weeks of FMLA. But this will need to be something that the Department of Labor clarifies via regulation, and we expect that to happen soon. There are no specific notice requirements. Unlike the EPSLA, you don't have to post an EFMLA poster. However, if your client is covered by the traditional FMLA, of course, they have to post an FMLA poster in their place of business. The law says that if the necessity for leave is foreseeable, the employee shall provide the employer with notice of leave as is practicable. I would tell employers not to take a rigid, restrictive view on what constitutes notice here. Don't require employees to provide a written request for leave under the EFMLA. For example, if they say that their child is out of school or that the child care provider can't come, and they say that verbally, that should be interpreted as sufficient notice for the employee invoking his or her rights under the EFMLA. As with the EPSLA, there are tax credits under the EFMLA, and that's supposed to reimburse employers for any paid sick leave payments under the EFMLA that they made. Again, these laws are intended to have a neutral financial impact on employers. Any amounts they pay out through sick leave under EPSLA or EFMLA, they get reimbursed via tax credit. The tax credits are capped at $200 a day and $10,000 per calendar quarter per employee, and they are applied against employer Social Security taxes, and employers are reimbursed if their cost for qualified leave exceeds the taxes they would owe. Again, the IRS has said they will be issuing guidance to address the cash flow challenge created by the tax credit. Same example that we ran through earlier applies here as well. Let's look at a couple of hypothetical scenarios here so we see how these laws are meant to apply to certain factual scenarios. Sally has been employed full-time for 20 days at a call center which employs 40 people. She is not eligible to receive any paid time off under her employer's policies. Sally has a sore throat and a fever of 100.7 degrees and cannot report to work. Sally is waiting to be seen by her doctor. What benefits is she entitled to while she is not working? So Sally is asking for leave related to her own health conditions. She has symptoms that could be COVID-19 and she is seeking a medical diagnosis. Therefore, she has a qualifying reason for leave under the EPSLA, and because it relates to her own health condition, she gets a full 80 hours at her full regular rate. She would not be entitled to leave under the EFMLA for two reasons. First, she was not employed for at least 30 days. It says here she was only employed for 20 days. And secondly, the reason for leave is not to take care of a child who is out of school or daycare, but it's for her own health condition. And remember, there's only one qualifying reason for leave under the EFMLA, and that is if you are unable to work or telework because your child is out of school or daycare. Scenario two, Sally has been employed full-time for 45 days at a call center which employs 40 people. As of today, she has accrued 3 days of PTO under her employer's policies. The school where her fourth grade daughter attends is closed until the end of April. Sally is unable to work from home during this time. What benefits is she entitled to receive during this time? So she would be entitled to up to 80 hours of paid leave under the EPSLA. It's 80 hours because she's a full-time employee, but it's only 2/3 of her regular rate of pay because it's not leave for her own health condition, it's to take care of her child. But because it is that reason, she's also entitled to leave under the EFMLA, up to 12 weeks of protected leave. The first 10 days would be unpaid, but remember, she's going to be paid during that first 10-day period under the EPSLA. So really, there should never be a period of unpaid leave if you have an employee who's taking leave to take care of a child, because they can be paid under both laws. And she would be paid at 2/3 of her regular rate of pay under the EFMLA for the weeks 2 through 12 as well. She can elect to use her 3 days of PTO, but she cannot be required to do that. So she could save those 3 days of PTO and use them at the end of the 12-week period if she chose to, or she could use them at any point during the 12-week period to supplement her pay if she chose to do that. But employers can't require her to use that accrued time before these laws take effect. One question we're getting from a lot of clients is, you know, schools are typically ending at the end of May. What if, you know, this school cancellation extends longer and an employee, for example, in June or July seeks to take leave under the EFMLA because schools are still in the same status that they are now, in other words, closed down? Can an employee elect to take paid leave under the EPSLA or EFMLA in June or July because of school cancellations, when June or July are periods when schools normally aren't open? And the answer is, we don't know at this point. Hopefully that will be a question that the Department of Labor addresses and clarifies when it issues regulations. There are some health provisions here. The EFMLA requires insured and self-insured group health plans to provide coverage for COVID-19 diagnostic testing without cost sharing. It requires insured and self-insured group health plans to cover provider and facility costs associated with diagnostic testing visits. The intent here is that employees should not come out of pocket anytime they are going in for testing. So there is obviously the news last evening of the Senate's stimulus bill. It's an 883-page document, and everyone is trying to digest it at this point. It has not yet passed the House, so there could be features in that Senate bill that fall out. There could be new features that come into it. Right now, it's premature. It's just too soon to say what will be in the final product. And as you see here, the House has its own 1,400-page proposal. So everyone really needs to sort of stay tuned to see what the final product looks like. But we all know that there will be funding in this bill for small businesses to help with payroll. And this is something we want to track as the legislation moves forward and results in a final product, because it could affect some of the funding mechanisms here. So stay tuned on this point. I do want to mention that many states and localities already have their own paid sick leave laws. So just because these new federal laws will be coming into existence next week and becoming effective next week, doesn't make those laws go away. One question we often get is, you know, which law do I have to comply with? And as a practical matter, whichever law is more generous to the employee, that should be the law that you comply with. So if there is a state leave law, for example, that provides, you know, a greater period of leave or at a higher rate of pay, you certainly need to follow that law during this time, even though there are new federal laws in place. And states and localities are acting just as the federal legislature is acting right now. So there's a lot of legislative activity happening at the federal, state, and local levels right now. So employers really need to be tuned in in following these developments. So I know I covered a lot there. Again, I will be happy to work with anyone out there who has follow-up questions. We will be issuing a legal alert very soon, later today, Thursday the 26th, on the new Senate bill. And of course, once there's a final piece of legislation after it's gone through the House, we will be issuing a legal alert on that as well, which summarizes the various positions that apply to employers. So please do go to our website regularly and check for legal alerts. And if anyone needs more in-depth legal advice on this or other employment law issues, including layoffs, WARN Act obligations, please don't hesitate to reach out to me and I'll be happy to work with you. Thanks very much and stay safe, everybody.